From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, men sentenced to life in prison, in their own words.
You have a lot of what we call intergenerational incarceration. We have a lot of fathers, sons, and grandfathers here.
We look at the school-to-prison pipeline, how one group of lifers is trying to stop the steady flow of new inmates. And
if you've been out of prison for 5 years and you still don't have a place to live, then I don't consider that a successful reentry.
So, how to succeed when you do get out? Life before, during, and after prison. Coming up on a special Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm here in our studio with one of our producers, Michael Simon Johnson.
Hi, Maria.
Hey, Michael. And you and I recently took a trip together.
That's right.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. So we're standing in front of the Greater Ferd State Prison, which is, we don't know what number.
It's a maximum security prison, the largest state prison in Pennsylvania, and actually the largest prison in Pennsylvania.
It's about a 45-minute drive north of Philadelphia, tucked away in the farmlands of tiny Skipack Township. The population is about 10,000.
At least, if you don't count the 4-ish thousand inmates.
It's about 9:15 in the morning. It's a gorgeous day. We're in the heart of rural Pennsylvania, where it's all green and lush and cows and horses. And then you look around and there are just, like, walls.
This prison, Greater Ferd, is surrounded by a huge 9-sided concrete wall.
30, 35, maybe 40 or 50 feet up.
Each side feels like the length of a football field. It's big.
And on each corner you see the guard posts, the heavily manned guard posts. What I know is that the last time that I was here was probably 8 to 10 years ago, and Suave called me yesterday and told me that the men are so excited about our visit so that they can talk about not letting this place define them, that the men haven't been able to sleep.
Suave is Luis Gonzalez, who is behind these walls, serving a life sentence. And full disclosure, I met Suave inside this prison 20 years ago. And since then, he's become something of a source as well as a friend.
There are no windows in the long hallway down. There are skylights at the top and wooden areas, but there is no direct sunlight that you can get.
This was my first time in a state prison, and you hear this a lot, but it really does feel like a high school.
What do you mean?
The atmosphere of the hallways, the way the building is structured, the way people are walking around kind of somewhat freely going somewhere, just felt like being in high school again.
But it was all middle-aged men, mostly.
Right, and significantly more security guards than in high school. And now they're, of course, correctional officers.
See, things seem pretty calm. It feels like a regular working day. As we were walking down one long hallway that's going to take us into an auditorium room, what we can see is basically one long hallway that's probably two short blocks long. And you have two floors. This one is C block.
Sir, how many blocks are there?
How many blocks? Five. A through E.
This is where Suave lives.
Yeah, he houses on this block. I don't know if he's in there. He does a lot of stuff.
Suave does do a lot of stuff. He's the president of a Latino outreach group called the Latin American Cultural Exchange Organization, or LACEO. He organizes a scholarship funded by inmates, and he's heavily involved with a program called FACT, Fathers and Children Together, which provides workshops for men at Greater Ferd on how to be better fathers to their children from behind bars.
People hear about us, whether it's the county jail or other people that come through here that met us. But what they don't know is that Suave is not the same dude that I was 27, 28 years ago.
That's Suave. We're here to talk to him and some of the members of his trusted circle of friends about the work that they do and how they've chosen to make their lives truly meaningful in a place that can be as hopeless as a maximum security prison.
Well, Suave said you were cool, so once he said you cool, you cool.
I figured you had serious meetings.
We were sitting in a huge auditorium.
Again, it felt like it was plucked right from a high school.
Talking with about 8 men, all of them serving life sentences. But they didn't want to talk about that. They wanted to talk about their main project, which is the FACT program. Here's Suave again.
Many of us grew up without fathers. Many of us don't know our fathers and probably won't ever know our fathers. So, but I think that just because we went through that, we don't have to expose our children to that.
The FACT program, Fathers and Children Together, was started by UCAN, the United Community Action Network, which is kind of like an inverse of a prison gang. It's a black network in Greaterford that focuses on social issues.
And that's what the beauty of the program is. It gives fathers the opportunity to be fathers.
At some point, after spending enough time here, these guys started noticing some disturbing trends. Here's the head of UCAN, Sam Brown, who goes by Magic.
You have a lot of what we call intergenerational incarceration. We have a lot of fathers, sons, and grandfathers here. It's real. I mean, on one block, we got, what was it, 5 father-sons pair on one block. We're not even talking about in the jail. So this is real.
The guys at UCAN, and eventually Suave and others, figured that maybe by helping bring fathers back into their children's lives, they might prevent the eventual incarceration of those children. After all, more than half of our country's state prison population are parents with children under 18, and the majority of those parents grew up in single-parent homes or in foster care. It becomes a kind of cycle. Here's Magic again.
Because many of us had kids, and we know the experience that our kids went through, trauma, depression, anxiety, because of their father not being there, embarrassed, shameful, all of those things that, put our kids in a bad situation. Many of us laid the groundwork for the out-of-control behavior that's going on in our community today.
We get into statistics.
That's Kempis Songster, also called Gani. He's another UCAN member.
We know about the 2.7 million children that have an incarcerated parent in this country and how they're 7 times more likely or 87% more likely to be incarcerated themselves if no positive intervention is made in their lives. We know that 75% of the homicides committed are by children that came up in single-parent homes.
So they started organizing workshops, classes, group sessions to help educate fathers on what it really means to be a father, getting down to some core basics like knowing your child's favorite color and asking how well they're doing in school. Magic again.
It's thorough to contact your child's teacher. It's thorough to make sure that your child is doing the right things. It's not just financially that I'm responsible for or accountable for. It's the other things that would be most important to make sure that my child is successful in life. That's what this program is really about.
In addition to workshops with fathers, the FACT program applies its teachings to visiting hours when children come up to see their fathers at Greaterford. Gani again.
So children, what they do is they walk around with the shame and secrecy of having an incarcerated parent. You know, but one thing this program does is by them being in a room filled with other children that's going through the same thing, it removes the shame and secrecy. Because they're like, wow, I'm not the only one. It's, you know, it's other people. It's a lot of other kids out here just like me.
Not long into our conversation, we heard some commotion coming from the hallway. All of us turned around to see what it was.
Tell me what you're seeing.
See how long the lines are? Those are orange jumpsuits, new admissions. And right now they're probably heading down to medical or maybe to commissary, or I don't know.
As if on schedule, we see a line of new inmates entering Greaterford through the hallway near the auditorium.
About 60% of them is probably 20 and younger.
That's Lloyd Reed. He goes by Shadid.
What is going on for you guys as we're sitting here talking and we can see the line of new admits? They're looking into the auditorium through the glass, trying to see what's going on here. You're looking at them and you're saying that every single day?
This is what we see. And I'm saying, you know...
Twice a day?
Sometimes three.
We're saying this. Y'all reading it about it out there. You might read Mark Morrow's Race to Incarcerate. You may read Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow. You read about these things, but we sit here and we watch, we see mass incarceration with our own eyes every day. And we have to do something about it.
Mass incarceration is almost an understatement. The U.S. has just shy of 7 million people in its adult correctional system, including prison, jail, parole, and probation. For perspective, that's almost the total population of New York City. Meanwhile, the number of juveniles in correctional facilities is hovering somewhere in the 60,000 to 70,000 range. Across the board, the United States imprisons more people than any other country in the world.
The United States has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's incarcerated.
That's Erica Miners, professor at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. She spent the last 20 years working on the relationship between education and incarceration, which is also known as the school-to-prison pipeline.
We've deliberately passed policies in the last 30 years that have built up what many folks call a prison nation, that have fulfilled our prisons and jails. We've criminalized poverty. We've criminalized drug addiction.
And those policies have extended to our public schools as well. A report last year from UCLA concluded that ninth grade suspensions significantly affect a student's chance of dropping out of high school, which in turn significantly affects the chance that student will wind up being arrested.
When we think about suspensions and expulsions, we think, wow, that kid must have done something really bad. But really, when we drill down to the data, you know, we see that things like disrespect, disobedience, things that are sort of vague are often, you know, kind of the locus or the reason for school disciplinary actions.
Part of what Erica is talking about is race. After all, Blacks are incarcerated at 6 times the rate of whites, and Latinos at 3 times the rate of whites. Numbers for those serving life terms, like these men at Greaterford, are similar. These kinds of stats, along with media, culture, and school curricula, all reinforce the idea that white people are the only ones who can succeed in society, and that for kids of color, oftentimes prison is the only place to go.
Imagine, you know, finishing high school and not reading about people who look like you doing anything meaningful and significant and how that shapes your understanding and political worldview, or going to a high school where you read and see and understand and are connected to people who look exactly like you that, you know, have had complex and transformative roles in making important pieces of art or music and politics and law. Control over curriculum, who gets to decide it, who doesn't, and why, is a central piece of kind of remaking our school-to-prison pipeline as well.
Tommy Robinson has been in Greaterford Prison since the mid-1990s. As he watches a slew of fresh inmates enter their new lives in prison, he says he understands the challenges facing them.
A lot of these young men that come in today never gave a thought about their future. Some of them expected to die at an early age, even sought to do that in some of the activities that they found themselves involved in. We just want to give our children some options.
Coming up on Latino USA, how this group of lifers built a foundation of change.
If I could get a dollar out of everybody around here, I figure we could sponsor a scholarship.
That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We've been meeting a group of incarcerated men at a prison in Pennsylvania called Greaterford, men who have decided to define themselves not by their circumstances, but rather by the work they do every day. One of those men is 45-year-old Luis Suave Gonzalez. I've had an unusual relationship with him for more than 20 years. He's really something between a source and a friend. Unlike most friends, though, my time with him is limited to the few trips I've taken to visit him in prison. And unlike most friends, he's a convicted murderer.
Hello? Suave?
Yes, yes.
Hey, Suave.
Suave once told me that he was innocent. And ever since then, I've chosen to believe him, though I suppose I'll never really know. But that's not why I find Suave so inspiring. It's Suave's constant dedication to try to reverse the influx of young Black and Latino men into the prison system that makes him fascinating to me. He spends his life every day trying to prevent others from ending up just like him. Now that I've met some of his friends inside the prison, I can say that his inspiration appears to live on within them as well. Producer Michael Simon Johnson came with me to visit Suave at Greaterford, and he picks up the story now.
To understand how significant it is for a group of men in prison for life to devote themselves to this cause, you need to really know where they're coming from. Ask any man serving a life sentence what his story is, and it might sound something like Suave's.
I grew up in the South Bronx, 149 Prospect Avenue, 6th train. When we grew up, it was drugs. The whole neighborhood was on drugs.
Suave, like so many other men in prison, grew up in a fatherless household. His mother, he says, was a hustler.
Crack, coke, weed, beer, pills, needles, whatever she could make a dollar of, she did. We used to get high together.
Well, how old were you?
About 10 years old. We smoked weed together. Yeah.
Without a father, his father figures were not ideal.
My father figures was the dudes, the drug dealers, the pimps, the people that was living large. You want to make some money? You got to sell this package. You want to have some nice girls? You got to have some money. You got to be the guy on the block.
In 1986, Suave's mother moved her family from the South Bronx to North Philadelphia.
So when I moved to Philly, I was in Philadelphia like maybe 3 months before I got arrested.
Here's what happened. Late one Saturday night in December 1986, a 17-year-old Suave and his 13-year-old friend, Axel Serrano, tried to rob another 13-year-old boy, Danny Martinez, of his new leather jacket. Danny refused to give up the jacket, but Suave and Axel didn't back down. Allegedly, Danny pulled a knife and tried to stab Suave. Then, according to police, Suave pulled out a handgun and shot Danny in the head. Suave and Axel were arrested, and Danny died in the hospital 3 days later. Suave spent almost a year and a half in a juvenile detention program before he was convicted of first-degree murder, robbery, and gun possession.
From day one, I accept responsibility for what landed me in prison, because now I realized that I could have walked away, but I didn't. Now, was I given a fair trial? No, but I'm not gonna minimize my role because I was present. So therefore, you know, I have to man up and take responsibility.
He has always maintained that it was his friend, Axel, who pulled the trigger that night, not him. But even if this were true, under Pennsylvania law, Suave would still be guilty of second-degree murder. Still, Suave was just a teenager, completely illiterate, and had no knowledge of the criminal justice system.
What the law said was, you'll be home. This is water under the bridge. You'll be home soon.
Who said that?
The lawyer. You'll be home soon. This is water under the bridge.
All we can know for sure is that Danny Martinez is dead, and Suave did not see home. Instead, he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, which guaranteed only one thing.
You basically got a death sentence. You gonna die in prison.
His accomplice, Axel, who, remember, was only 13, got a much shorter sentence and has been in and out of prison ever since. Suave spent the first 2 years of his sentence at Camp Hill, a medium security prison then used to house young offenders. At Camp Hill, his reckless lifestyle, unchanged from his life out on the streets, got him in trouble, and he wound up in solitary confinement, also called the hole, he says, for 6 months.
Then when I was down there, I met this older guy. He's been in the hole like 10 years at that time. I used to ask him, can you write my letters for me? And he was like, no, but I'm going to show you how to read.
You were able to talk to somebody in the darkness?
Yeah, we used to talk. He was like two cells away from me, and he used to give me a word every day.
Do you remember some of the words that he taught you?
Mother, father, cat, request. I mean, simple words, but it was words to me that was big words because I ain't know none of them.
In 1989, a prison-wide riot at Camp Hill forced a large number of prisoners, including Suave, to transfer out. He had a brief stay at Leavenworth Prison in Kansas and then Texarkana in Texas before ending up at Graterford in 1991. There, he recalls hearing Maria on the radio.
In my cell. And the only station it would play was NPR radio. So one day I heard this lady. And I was like, damn, she Puerto Rican. I didn't know she was Mexican. I thought she was Puerto Rican.
Maria was invited by Graterford's head of education to speak at a sort of commencement ceremony where lots of inmates were in attendance, including Suave.
So when she came in, I introduced myself.
How old were you?
I was about 21.
Maria, do you remember meeting Suave?
I remember giving the speech, and then after the speech, I remember meeting a lot of many inmates.
So we start talking. She tell me, where are you from? I said, I'm from New York, the Bronx. And that's hit it all.
But one in particular, this guy Suave, was just like,
I'm from here. I live in Harlem on the block.
Hey, you know, can I stay in touch with you? And I was like, sure.
But,
you know, here's my address.
3 o'clock came. She had to leave.
And then he started writing to me.
But the very last word she said, you can become the voice for the voiceless. And that put my whole life on a different direction. After that, I went to school. I said, then if I'm gonna be involved with these people and try to talk like I'm smart, I gotta really be smart.
With his growing ability to read, Suave restarted his education by getting his GED.
Took me 7 times to get a GED. I mean, it's a lot of times.
Then he signed up for college classes through a joint program with Villanova University. For the first time in his life, he started learning.
History, theology, math, statistics.
It took him 16 years to graduate from Villanova. Incarcerated students can't take a full course load the way other students can. But that didn't discourage him.
I think it was the best 16 years of my life. My mother, she ain't know how to read and write. None of my siblings, they all drop out of high school. So to be able to show them, my nieces, my nephews, and the people that look up to me, that it could be done, it's make me emotional.
During those 16 years, much of Suave's environment was changing, not all of it for the better. For starters, Graterford Prison itself was going through historic turmoil. It was considered a war zone.
People was getting stabbed. People was getting their cells robbed.
The place was steeped in drug culture, made possible by a shadow market run by inmates in collaboration with some of the guards. At the time, it was estimated that 1/3 of Pennsylvania state prison drug sales were happening within Graterford, even though the prison housed only 1/10 of the state's incarcerated population.
It was like being in the streets in here. The only thing I was locked up.
Here's Tommy Robinson, one of the lifers at Graterford and a friend of Suave's.
The guards can come in 4 o'clock in the morning and jump you because they don't like you. Other confined citizens who didn't like you would come in there because you didn't give them a honey bun or something.
Tommy, you're using a particular set of words to describe people who are here. What do you call them?
to find citizens or incarcerated citizens. We don't lose our citizenship because we're incarcerated. We're family members. We're human beings.
Over the course of Suave's prison term, he began cultivating a trusted group of friends who shared his emerging passion for learning, for growing, and ultimately for social justice. Guys like Sam Brown, who goes here by Magic. He runs the African-American organization in Greaterford called You Can.
And we have been talking for a while before we even got together.
But I know when I was in Texarkana, Texas, Puerto Ricans and Mexicans didn't mix. Blacks and Mexicans didn't mix. That could be my friend from the city, but when I was in the jail, we couldn't eat together. And this was a known fact.
In the 2000s, Greaterford, despite its tumultuous and violent history, was becoming a place where racial barriers were not nearly as prohibitive as they were in other prisons. And at least part of that burgeoning flicker of racial harmony can be credited to an idea, an inmate-run scholarship fund.
That was Suave's idea.
That's Tommy again.
For a man who says that when he first came here couldn't read and write, I will say this about the brother, that he do come up with some ingenious ways that we can give back to our community.
When I spoke about it, there people looked at me like, this dude was crazy. here it goes again. So I went around and said, look, we could do this. And the way I figure it out, if I could get a dollar out of everybody around here, I figure I could, we could sponsor a scholarship.
You were figuring if you could get $1.
$1.
From how many people?
From everybody.
4,200 people.
This is a 4,200.
Yeah. Actually, it's built to house 4,000 individuals, but we're over capacity.
And what ended up happening was the brothers in Greaterville stepped up when we told them what we was doing. People was giving up $10. $5.
$100.
The typical citizen in here get paid anywhere from 18 to 42 cents an hour.
Either as a block worker who takes out the trash and sweeps the floor, or in the garment factory attached to the prison, or in the shoe factory, or any other number of manual labor jobs.
I mean, to give up $5 in here, that's like almost half a month of work. And the first time we did it, we had 862 people that donated.
They ended up with $900.
See, it's more than just the money that we produce or collect for the scholarship. It's more sending a message to society saying that we're not gonna stand by. Yeah, we understand it might be $5 for three students a piece. We know that's not a lot of money to go to college, but it can help with books, it can help with clothing.
And today we got 12 scholarships. We're giving out three this year, and it's going lovely.
I didn't know that it was coming from them at first. Like, I've never heard of that. It caught me off guard. It really did. I didn't expect it.
That's Carlos Gonzalez and George Dandrade, two recipients of the Education Over Incarceration Scholarship.
All the time they spent to save it, and they just give it to me for education.
But it really touched my heart to know that they really, like, worked hard. You're working for, like, a little bit of money for the time they put in work. And for them to really just put in all that effort, just in, not for themselves, but for the kids out there that actually can make a change, I was touched. I ain't gonna lie.
The scholarship is now run jointly by both UCAN and LACEO. And the guys all say that the unity of the Black and Latino groups comes from a place of recognizing that the problem is bigger than either one of those groups.
We suffer from the same disease, which is our people getting incarcerated.
It's very seldom that you see African-American and Latino organizations working together. But we understand of a lot of things that's affecting us as a people, and they're common. So why not work together to try to turn that around?
The scholarship, along with FACT, the fatherhood program, even caught the attention of people on the outside.
First thing I thought was how they're able to do this.
That's Dr. Gene Wright.
Well, I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist, and I'm director of behavioral health and justice services at the Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services.
From a clinical perspective, when you see men who are behind bars for life, getting involved in activities that are trying to change the scenario. What kind of an impact does that have?
Well, clearly, the impact on the gentleman on the inside is it returns a sense of self-worth. It increases self-value. It reminds individuals that regardless of my particular circumstance or what appears to be limitations, that I have something that is needed and something that I can contribute. And so it returns your humanity to you that may have been stripped away by other means or other situations.
When someone is sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, it means that once they're in, they'll never get out, right? Suave received his sentence as a juvenile, but only because at the time, that was the only sentence for first-degree murder in Pennsylvania. In other words, once he was found guilty, the judge had no other choice but to sentence Suave to life. But just over 2 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled in Miller v. Alabama that it's unconstitutional to automatically sentence juveniles to life without parole. The ruling forces judges to consider more factors, like age, before handing down a sentence. After all,
we recognize that juveniles are different.
That's Brandon Buskey, a lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union, who works on the Criminal Law Reform Project.
They're more impulsive. They are more susceptible to peer pressure, but also they are more capable of rehabilitation. Study after study has shown that when you look at the mind of a juvenile, it is literally not finished. And so the court says, you know, when we look at, you know, why we punish, when we look at the goals of putting someone in prison, a sentence of life without parole in a juvenile doesn't really serve any of them.
This means no one will be sentenced the way Suave was ever again. But Pennsylvania has declared that the ruling will not be applied retroactively to people just like Suave who are already serving their time. So it comes down to a basic question. What are the goals of putting someone in prison?
There are things like retribution, deterrence. And when you think about juveniles, none of those really matches up, right? They are simply not of the maturity to consider fully culpable for their acts in almost all cases, right? As the Supreme Court acknowledges in Miller, it is the rare juvenile who cannot be saved.
Inside this massive prison, surrounded by 50-foot walls that Suave might not ever leave.
My dream is to get out and work with juveniles.
I hang out with him.
Especially Latinos.
Suave, child of poverty.
I can relate to them.
Convicted murderer.
I know the street language. I come from where they come from.
Confined citizen.
And they're not doing nothing that I ain't done.
And now, leader, organizer, and role model.
I always said, you give me 10 of the worst juveniles.
So I find myself wondering.
And I guarantee you in 30 days, they'll be your good guys.
Is he not saved? Coming up on Latino USA, the challenges of returning home from prison.
You have a lot of people who, you know, maybe have been sitting in their cell for 10 or 15 years thinking about when I get out, I'm going to go to college.
That's coming up. No se vayan.
After go to bed, and that woman drove.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We've been talking about prison, what brings people there, and what some choose to do with their lives when they're locked away for life. But what happens when you do get out? Where do you go? How do you find a job? Just because you're out of prison, does it mean you're really free? To get some answers, we went to the Exodus Transitional Community, which is a re-entry program in East Harlem, not far from our office. They're trying to help people who are recently incarcerated answer some of these questions and ultimately help them reclaim their lives.
When someone walks in, you know, it's, did you eat today? Where'd you sleep? Because we understand this population.
Benito, wake up, brother.
My name is Julio Medina, kind of the head cleaner here. You know, I'm the executive director of Exodus.
Oh, this is my resume workshop, right? And what we do is as I said before, I'm going to empower you, brothers, to write your own resume.
Exodus was started many years ago. I was in prison. I served 12 years in prison. During my own incarceration, I ran into a lot of good people. And we saw good people who were released return. And we asked ourselves, why are they returning? And why? Well, some of the reasons they were returning, of course, you know, no jobs, the scarlet letter, the felony. You know, how do we kind of adjust back to a family that doesn't know us because we've been away 5, 10, 15 years? So we began to look at those things. And there was a model, it's called the Exodus model.
You have a lot of people who, you know, maybe have been sitting in their cell for 10 or 15 years thinking about, when I get out, I'm going to go to college. And they might not even have a GED. And going to college is like a huge goal with a ton of steps. So with that contract, we say like, okay, what's your first action? Okay, my first action is to study for the GED.
Oh yeah, here, Cole. If you fold a piece of notebook paper in half six times, how many rectangles of the same size are formed by the folding?
I got 32. There's 32 there, too. There's a 32 there, right?
You folded it six times?
I folded it six times and I got 32 boxes.
You sure?
Yeah.
Let me fold it.
I don't know.
Six times. This is one, two, three, four.
I'm Mike. Five, I'm the GED instructor here. And it's rough. I mean, one of the problems is you come out of jail and you don't have your GED and you spent maybe 15, 10, 20 years inside. Now, you don't have any skills, where are you going to find a job? And if you do have a find a job, there's anything, a bump in the economy, you're the first one to be let go.
I was incarcerated for 27 years, and I just got out in December of 2012. So I've heard that it takes a little longer for, you know what I'm saying, for a person to get on their feet after doing so many years. And being that I didn't apply myself in prison like I was supposed to take advantage of the programs that they had in there, and I didn't because I was too busy getting in trouble and hanging out and thinking that was the move. So I didn't get my GED like I should have had. I could have probably had a college degree because I started my bid like when I was in 86. So here I am now after so many years trying to get a GED now. You know, I'm 51 now, so, you know, I'm trying.
So when I was released, I didn't go through a program like Exodus. I was released, and let's just say in brief, you know, when I reached out to those programs, it was, you know, the welcome I expect, I don't expect to go into, you know, one of those taken numbers and wait for us to get back to you. The sense of urgency that I feel getting out, I don't think organizations felt that. I just felt, where can people come and not be judged and not be kind of alienated and find a home, find a place where they really understand and people understand what that experience is?
That audio postcard was produced by Julia Alsop. That was Julio Medina, Michael Kwan, Lila McDowell, Ishmael Bonitz, and Jose Munoz at Exodus, a transitional community based here in Harlem in New York City. One of the people who is a real believer in the Exodus program is a woman by the name of Rosana Rosado. She's a journalist who has made an enormous difference in New York City media over the last 20 years, most notably by publishing the Spanish-language newspaper El Diario La Prensa. But over the last 4 years, she's become a volunteer and a consultant with the Exodus program. We invited her to give us a bit more context as to what re-entry back into society is really like for those people who are leaving prison. She joins us now in our studios in West Harlem. Welcome back to Latino USA, Rosana.
Thank you.
You have just been recently appointed by the governor of New York State to be part of New York State Council on Community Reentry and Reintegration. In fact, you're heading up this council. You hope to make a big change in terms of reentry in New York. Why is reentry such a big issue for you?
I really believe in redemption, in second chances. I believe that if we have, as a society, decided a long time ago that, you know, this is the number of years in prison, that is the punishment for this crime, that if we accept that all that is valid, then the moment someone is released, there should be a blank slate.
What, in fact, are the basic challenges facing someone who's getting out of prison?
Well, you know, there are three essential things that people need, you know, when they get released from prison, or that are the challenges to success. And it's housing, it's employment, and it's family support. So, you know, those three challenges are challenges for anyone coming home from the war or anyone coming back from college, right? Employment, housing, and support.
You like to make these comparisons about saying it's not just people getting out of prison. It's, in fact, it's as if you finished college, you've been gone for 4 years. It's as if you went and you served and you've been. You like to make the issue of having been in prison something that is not as shocking, is something tangible. Do you do that on purpose? Because,
well, I think I do that intuitively because it's the way it is. I mean, there are parallels, except this is a situation where incarceration is the deconstruction of a human being. There are scientists who have measured how many decisions we make in a day, for example, something like 35,000 decisions we make in a day. So we decide we're going left or right, or we're going to eat this or that. And for someone who's in prison, it's like 125 decisions they make a day, because decisions are made for them. It's, you know, it's prison. It's incarceration. It's kind of a deconstruction of all that makes you human. So that when people are released from prison, we have to reconstruct. They come back, they don't know how to take the subway, they've never seen a cell phone.
One of the markers for a lot of people around reentry is recidivism. It's, well, that seems to make sense. Like, if it's working, it means that they're not going back. And you say recidivism.
Well, you know, it makes sense, but it's only one thing. So, for example, I have a guy who's been out of prison for 5 years. They're off parole. They have they're getting their voting rights back. They're employed. They have a job where they don't have health insurance. They're still in transitional housing. We have guys who've been out for 6 to 8 years and are still in transitional housing. So they go from one program to the other, because I don't have to tell you how hard it is to find housing in New York. There are other barriers when it comes to housing. Their wife or their mother or their family who could house them live in public housing. You know, it's a federal mandate. They're not, you know, if you're a felon, you're not allowed to go to live in public housing. So there are all these barriers when you think about finding a place to live. So if, in my opinion, if you've been out of prison for 5 years and you still don't have a place to live, then I don't consider that a successful reentry.
This country has the highest percentage of people behind bars, and it's only growing, and the fastest growing group of people behind bars is Latino. Then what's the bigger picture?
A lot of Latino leaders in leadership, and I'm talking about both electeds and other leaders across the country, they don't want to own this issue. And sometimes I just want to scream and say, who do you think is in prison? But for me, the big picture is, A, that this is our issue, this is a Latino issue, and this is a family issue. When people start the conversation with quotes about recidivism, I'm like, okay, let's take this in another direction. I want to tell you the story about this young man who I met at Sullivan County 7 years ago, and he said to me that he grew up across the street from the Bronx Zoo. So he would look out his window and he would see people going into the Bronx Zoo, and he always wondered what was going on beyond those gates. And Maria, when I was driving home, I was in tears, because I thought, how messed up are the adults in this 8-year-old's life when nobody could take him by the hand and walk him across the street to the zoo?
You want to make this into a human story, but there are numbers behind it as well.
So share that number.
There's a report that just came out a month ago. So Jeremy Travis, who's the president of John Jay College of Criminal Justice, wrote the report that was put together by a committee, and it came out of the National Academy of Sciences. So it's very serious, very, very data driven. An African-American male born in the 1940s who dropped out of high school had a 15% chance of being incarcerated for at least a year before reaching the age of 35.
Okay, so that was 15% chance.
15% chance. For an African-American male born in the 1970s, during the prison buildup, if he was a high school dropout, that probability increased to 68%. Going to prison is now a high probability life experience for a black high school dropout. What does this say for the future of our country? And when I say black in this country, when you say black, it's everybody who's not white. So we're there. Latinos are in there, in that number when you look at that.
For all of your work, Rosana, thank you so much. And thank you for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
As we've heard, prison can be a place that sucks you in and doesn't prepare you for life back on the outside. But sometimes, the lowest points in life can bring a clarity and purpose unmatched by anything else. Two things that are essential to surviving in the world post-incarceration. We hear now from Ralphie Dominguez, a young leathersmith, former inmate, and now an entrepreneur, as he talks about how he honed his family's skills inside prison to start a new life on the outside.
This is like fresh off the gator.
Yeah.
Like this is a gator-shaped like piece of leather.
Yeah, this is a gator. These are the little arms. This would be the head, but I cut the head. I made a wallet out of it. My dad's side is always, like, they've always been carpenters, and my mom's side of the family is, especially all the females, have always been, like, seamstresses, like, cutting sew. I mean, I was young, and I was always at the store, like, just messing around. I would just make just a lot of, like, wristbands, like, you know, those hippie wristbands, rockstar wristbands.
I'd put it on the leather, like that. Get the saw right here. And then I would just etch it out.
Yo, tell you the truth, I was a straight-A student, like... I was in honor roll. I was in Dean's List my first two semesters, and I just started partying, man. Like I friends on my phone in my same dorm room, and they asked me, you know, well, cocaine, can't you get it for us? I'm like, yeah, I mean, I could. I met up with my brother. My brother hooked up the connection, and I started selling drugs, man. So that led to, you know, 1 gram, which led to, you know, me buying 10, which led to me buying 50. I guess at the height of that college, my college career, which was my senior year, I mean, I had 10 people working for me all throughout New England, different colleges.
Wow.
We're talking up all the way to New Hampshire, all the way to Canada. Well, the investigation said it was about $2 million a year, but it was a lot more than that. I mean, actually, you see that suitcase right there?
Yeah.
I'd bring that suitcase with me, loaded with money from San Diego.
So you gotta hear the gas.
Heat the stamp just a little bit. You don't want to overheat it. If you overheat it, it's going to burn right through the leather, and it's not going to be good. I got sentenced to 5 years. At the beginning, I was just going, like, I was still rebellious. Like, I'm getting all this time. I was drinking. Like, I was smoking weed still in there, and I went to segregation for it. While I was in SEG, I would see myself in this mirror every day, and it was warped. And I just saw myself in that mirror for 60 days straight. Like, that's what my whole college experience was. It was just a warped, like, one whole long day, and it just hit me there. Like, it's in solitary, by myself. Like, I had a pet ant that I would keep under a cup, and that's who kept me company for 60 days. And when I came out all scruffy, like, beard all grown, and I was trying to find something. I was trying to find something to do to get me away from the trouble. And there was this craft course that I had no idea about, and it was for leather, and it was straight leather, like... And it was just guys, like, stamping away, working on their own. And I went to it, and I was, like, thrilled. I was like, I can't believe this is here. I'm going to make full use of this.
So here, I'll show you. And we used wax thread, which lasts a lot longer.
You could buy the leather right from the prison. Like, they had exotic skins, which I always loved to work on. And that was my thing. Like, I always knew exotic leathers were in demand. Marketed right and made right and packaged right, it could be something for the general population.
And then this is my workspace. This is where I create, design, cut.
Wow.
So yeah, dude, I've been here for about a month and a half now, putting in work. Retouching some shots that we took the other day for marketing purposes, because our site, I just wanted to be clean. Every day I had to wake up and try to see where I'm gonna make that sale to support myself, support my business. So it's a risk that I'm willing to take, just because I'm tired of having to, you know, fail at applying for jobs and applying for other positions. So if I'm gonna fail, I'm gonna fail to my own credit or merit. I mean, I'm not getting rich by any means, but it's a better way to make a buck.
You can find out more about Ralphie's business on our website, latinousa.org. For this week's Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, we go back to Rosana Rosado, who told us this story about freedom and how it's not always what you expect.
My favorite quote from a guy who I met about 6-7 years ago, Angel, he said to me, he had done about 28 years of prison and he was out. And he said in those early days, then the first 2 weeks he was out, he goes, you know, I was walking in the park, it's at that River State Park. And he's like, I stepped in shit. And at first I was annoyed and then I just started laughing. He was like, oh my God, I stepped in. This is like the best symbol that I'm free.
Mis queridos y queridas, that's it for this week on Latino USA. Our show is produced by Michael Simon Johnson, AC Valdez, Katie Davis, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Julia Alsop, Sarah Barrett, Sara Rocha, and Roxanne Scott. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen with the help of interns Sayer Devlin and Katia Wasasalva. Special thanks this week to Ron Waters, Penny McDonald, Wendy Shaler, Tom Arvanites, Vivian Robledo-Shorey, and Louis Canganis. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and check out our new Instagram, LatinoUSA, all one word. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Is that what that is?
Yeah. No, this is the butt.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.